WSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Captain Waldron is preparing his papers to ask questions. Now we'll hear from Commander Waldron.
Commander. Okay.
Afternoon, Captain. We've had several people testify, including ship's personnel, the pilot, Coast Guard personnel, stating that there was no obvious evidence of impairment on the part of Captain Hazelwood. As to the captain, there was testimony that he left the bridge for an hour and a half during the transit of Valdez Narrows. He put the vessel on autopilot in pilotage waters. He cut across the TSS and outside of the traffic separation scheme. He gave the con to a third mate. Without a pilotage endorsement. He did not come up when telephoned by the third mate that he was a beam of Busby light. After the accident, he left the engine room going ahead at load program up for an additional 14 minutes.
Commander, are you summarizing the testimony that we've heard in the last 3 days?
I do have a question. And afterwards, he was smoking up on the bridge. Would you consider any of these actions impairment, evidence of impairment?
I really don't know whether they'd be impairment or not.
Okay. Could you tell me what Exxon does to ensure that 6 hours of rest are given to ship's personnel, to the deck watch officer, prior to getting underway?
We don't have any program to get 6 hours of rest to any deck officer before we get underway. On the ships I've been on, we have made sure that, or I've made sure, that once we've taken departure, and if no one's had rest, then I'll stay up on the bridge and stand the watch until someone's got enough rest to come and take the watch and meet the law.
On the ship, whose responsibility is it to ensure that the watch officers had 6 hours within the last 12 hours?
That'd be the master's responsibility.
Thank you. I understand that you met with Captain Hazelwood in a stateroom right after you boarded the vessel. Could you tell me what the purpose of the meeting was, what was said, and was the cause of the casualty discussed?
The cause of the casualty might have been discussed, but I wasn't present when it was done. When we got to the stateroom, I left pretty soon afterwards, went up to the bridge, talked to the mate on watch, went to talk to the chief engineer, and at that point, Mr. Nicholas, our attorney, was talking to Captain Hazelwood, and I never really discussed the accident with Captain Hazelwood, except I did mention to him just before he left the vessel that this was something much bigger than he could imagine by sitting where he was right then, and to be prepared for quite a lot of attention when he got ashore.
After listening to Mr. Cousins, Mr. Kagan, and Mrs. Jones, is it your impression that Mr. Cousins knew exactly where he was on the chart when he relieved the deck prior to the grounding?
When he relieved the deck?
When he was given the con from the captain.
I believe he knew exactly where he was when he relieved the captain.
Up until the time of the grounding?
I believe he thought he knew where he was the whole time.
And what do you base this on?
On his testimony.
Do you agree that he had available to him a chart, an operating radar, and sufficient visibility, and a lookout, and illuminated aids to navigation to help him determine his position accurately?
Yes.
Do you believe, therefore, that Mr. Cousins needed any information from the VTS traffic system to determine his position?
No, he didn't.
Couple of questions about drug testing. This vessel apparently had a drug sampling kit aboard. The requirements do not, the regulations do not require it until December. Why did it have it on at this time?
Exxon's drug and alcohol policy, which we've got some documents on, was implemented just recently. And part of our policy is to, if certain conditions are met, to require testing of an employee to determine whether they've been using drugs on board the vessel.
Does Exxon have breathalyzers on board, or are there any plans to put breathalyzers on board?
They're not on board yet, but we are planning on having them on board this year sometime, I believe.
The new regulations that are going to be coming into effect requires that post-casualty testing include samples of urine and blood or urine and breath. Is part of your drug testing or drug policy address the need to take blood samples?
No, our policy right now is just to take urine samples. I don't know whether that's going to change in the future, but right now it's just urine samples.
Thank you, Captain.
Dr. Woodrush.
Thank you. Captain Deppe, just two or three here. Has Exxon issued any written policy directives to masters in the North Slope trade regarding response to navigation oil spills?
Could you refine that a little bit? The response from on board the vessel, is that what
yes,
you mean?
Yes, yes.
In what sense? In a reporting sense or in a active sense of fighting the spill?
In the latter sense, Bill.
No, we've got regulations as far as reporting what's happened, and we've got guidance about trying to minimize what's occurred, but there's no capability on board, except in a very minor sense, to be able to clean up the spill.
Okay, thanks. Does Exxon Shipping require any training of masters and other licensed officers in the areas of vessel management, for example?
We've spent an awful lot of time over the last 3 or 4 years in improving our vessel management skills and working with people to improve communications, to break down some of the barriers between licensed and unlicensed deck and engine departments, to improve the teamwork among individuals on the ship, to try to improve efficiency through better ideas, getting the unlicensed to come up with ways of doing their jobs better and more efficiently, trying to improve the safety of our vessels the same way. We went through, everyone in the fleet was invited to a 5-day program, we called it Excel, where we went through training for that five days with some many outside consultants to come up with the program and different techniques of accomplishing this improved communications and improved leadership.
Did any of the officers on board the Valdez in the voyage in question have this training?
I would imagine they all did.
Do any of the masters or officers in your fleet required to have training in leadership or interpersonal skills? If so, what specific courses are they required to take?
Well, like I just said, the course that we just took, and I believe it ended 2 years ago, was called LEAP, and it was Leadership Enhancement Program, is what it was. So the program was to develop better leadership, and every person in the fleet was invited to go to attend that program.
When you say invited in this sense, does that mean required?
Well, the officers were more or less required. The unlicensed people were invited.
So everybody who was an officer or a master 2 years ago, you feel certain went to that course?
99.5%. There might have been one or two that slipped through.
Okay. you spoke about being ready to install breathalyzers on board the vessels. When would those be used?
Well, this is something that's been in the works ever since the new Coast Guard regulations were proposed that are going to be coming into effect at the end of this year. And part of them was to have a breathalyzer on board each ship. So we've been researching it for a while. And I imagine sometime this year we'll have the research completed and we'll have the breathalyzers installed.
If they're installed, what will you do with them?
They'll be used in conjunction with meeting the requirements for the new regulations.
Do you have any idea of what those requirements are?
Yeah, I read them last year, and I forget exactly what we have to do, but I imagine if someone appears intoxicated, this gives us a means of determining whether they are intoxicated or not.
So you'll put them on board and use them to meet the minimum requirements of these regulations?
Well, I imagine we'll do more than meet the minimum requirements with them. We will probably be proactive in using them to avoid any problems with our people.
Who will be responsible for conducting these tests, you figure?
I'd imagine the master will be.
The master. Thanks, Mr. Deppe.
Captain Duncan, will you identify yourself and then... Thank you, Captain. Mr. Colucciello.
Captain Deppe, there's been a lot of talk about how bad the fumes were after the spill and whether or not there was a high danger of fire or explosion. Do the Exxon tankers carry explosion meters on board?
Yes, we do.
Do you know whether or not anyone suggested using them to measure the atmospheres around the ship that evening or when you came aboard?
When I was there, Mr. Colucciello, there was no fume problem at that point.
Mm-hmm. And to your knowledge, did anyone use the explosion meter prior to your arrival?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay. On the class of vessel, the Exxon Valdez, do you know approximately where the pivot point is for its turning?
It's probably around tank two center.
Which is about, in percentage of the length of the ship from the bow, about how much?
Probably about one-third of the way back.
Mm-hmm. No. Presumably, Captain Hazelwood went below to work on ship's papers. And he was there, I understand, through the transit through Port Valdez and the Narrows, which is a fairly substantial amount of time. When you took over, did you find behind that he'd left papers that he'd been working on that would indicate that this is what he had been doing?
No, I didn't find anything that would indicate that he was working on papers at the time that he was down below there, but I don't know what your office looks like, but any master's office on a ship is pretty much full of papers and things hanging all over the place, and it's it's kind of hard to determine when one paper was worked on versus another paper.
With respect to what a ship perhaps could do in the event of a spill, do you believe it's feasible for a tanker to carry, say, booms that they could quickly put over the side and boom the ship in a case like this and do it using the crew and the ship's boats?
I don't think that is very feasible, Mr. Colucciello. Anything can be done, but the manpower is not available for that kind of thing, and the equipment certainly isn't. I don't think that would be very feasible at all.
No more questions. Thank you.
Mr. Danaher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Deppe, I'd like to return briefly to the personnel records that have been placed in on Captain Hazelwood that have been placed into the record. Earlier, Dr. Berkey reviewed some of the appraisals, and we learned also that from Mr. Iarassi that there is an attempt to have an annual appraisal. In looking at those that have been submitted, it would appear that from perhaps 84 up until 86 or 7, there are none, no appraisals. And it occurred to me that seems to coincide with the period under which Captain Hazelwood was undergoing rehabilitation and perhaps post-rehabilitation monitoring. And I believe Mr. Iarassi mentioned that there were two management people who were specifically assigned responsibility for continuing surveillance of him. Is there any chance that this annual appraisal system was set aside and that during this period there were different monitoring and paper reporting on him? And if so, there might be other records elsewhere.
I don't believe so. I believe if you went through all of our master's files, you might find the same gap in all of them. There might have been something taking place ashore. I'm not quite sure whether we might have changed fleet managers during that period, also changed some of the personnel ashore, and Captain Hazelwood moved from one coast to another, I believe, in that period. So it's possible that other outside factors influenced why they aren't there rather than any other records anywhere else.
Have you any knowledge of any other documentation that is made periodically on people who are undergoing or have undergone the rehabilitation program?
I don't know of anyone who is in the rehabilitation except Captain Hazelwood.
Okay. Briefly, I'd like to touch on assignment of masters to vessels. In some transportation modes, there is a bidding system to encompass vehicle operators' preferences. And this is based on seniority quite often, and it's an attempt to accommodate people's preferences for type of vehicle, trips, and in fact, compensation is a consideration as well. Is there anything comparable in the shipping industry, and specifically at Exxon?
I can't speak for the shipping industry. At Exxon, you can make your personal preference known to people, and if it fits into the system and we can meet the request, we will try to meet it. But there is no extra compensation for any special vessel. Compensation is based on performance, and you could be on the smallest vessel and be the highest paid person, be on the biggest vessel and be the lowest paid person. It doesn't matter. There's no union type seniority thing. There's no bidding for jobs. If someone wanted to be on the Exxon Valdez, they could make a request that, hey, I'd like to go on one of those ships, and if we could meet it, and they fit fit into be the type of person we need on that ship, then we might make the transfer. But it generally doesn't work that way too often.
Thank you. To what extent is seniority a factor in considering such assignments, or in accommodating an individual's preference.
All things being equal, I guess seniority might come into play, but we don't change master's positions that often. What happens is we have a person assigned to a ship or two people assigned to a ship, and they might be there for 3 or 4 years, and we would not move one of those people off to accommodate someone else. If a person left or requested a transfer and an opening resulted on a ship, we might look at who is available to fill that position, wanted to go to that position, and then pick from those people. But we would never change a person just for seniority reasons or anything like that.
With respect to seniority, it would appear, and also compensation, it would appear that there is a bonus system, and that one's ranking in this overall ranking scheme determines the magnitude of the bonus that one gets. Is that the way it works?
Last year there was a bonus system. Exxon's compensation system is based upon what's paying its people. The industry has not shown very many pay increases over the last several years, so Exxon has not increased the salaries of its seagoing people during the last several years. But in order to compensate people for the extra work that's done upon a ship, aboard a ship, or the extra management type things that are done, a bonus type program has been approved, and that ranking list that you saw was to distribute money in that bonus system.
I see. One final question. Again, Mr. Colucciello was talking about the masters going below outbound to do paperwork, and I believe earlier we heard testimony to suggest that he was preparing departure messages. Can you imagine any paperwork of a sufficiently urgent nature at departure time that should give consideration to preempting his presence on the bridge?
No.
Thank you.
Captain Deppe, just a few follow-on questions to Exhibit 5, Bravo. If I look, do you have those with you?
Chairman Lee Dickinson is now asking questions of Captain William Deppe, the man who took over the helm of the Exxon Valdez after Captain Hazelwood was fired and taken off the ship.
If you look at the first appraisal review, period 82 to 83, when Mr. Hazelwood was the master of the Exxon Baton Rouge, okay? These appraisal reviews are typed, at least the remarks are, comments are. So that would appear to me that there's probably, well, let me ask the question a different way. When somebody's appraised, are these forms filled out by hand and then they're given to somebody else for typing? Or does somebody sit there and type the appraisal at the same time they're reviewing the master?
I'm not quite sure how this one was done. I would imagine it was done by hand and then probably given to one of the secretaries to type, but I'm just guessing that.
Okay, if that's the case, would there be a hard copy of a handwritten document somewhere that may be signed?
I have no idea.
Who would know that? Who should know that?
I imagine the fleet manager during 1982 would have to be asked that question.
Okay, let's look at the next exhibit from June of 83 to June of 84. That's handwritten. Again, it's not signed. And we don't know what position the master had, or at least what vessel the master was on during that period. Is there any other way to check to find out on what vessel this was taken, or what position he had during that period?
Yes, our personnel office could give him a whole history of what ships he's been assigned to over his whole career here.
Okay, would it be possible that personnel office would have other information in a review fashion like this?
I believe they'd have assignment information. This information would not be in the personnel office.
How would you, as in your position, let's just the appraisal review that we're looking at here from 83 to 84, how would you know that this is a valid appraisal with no signature if you were the one that's reviewing a master's history?
Well, since it's not signed, I wouldn't know that.
Okay, how would you, looking at the first appraisal from 82 to 83 that's typed but not signed, how would you know that is accurate?
Same answer for that. I wouldn't know.
So therefore, if you were reviewing this particular person over that two-year period, trying to do a review, you may not have any, are you saying you may not have any accurate information or valid information on this individual?
I would assume that these are valid, but I could not prove that they're valid.
Why would you make that assumption?
I can't imagine that they would get into our system if in any other way than through the regular routine in the office.
Are these checked? Does anybody look at these besides the person doing the appraisal review?
I'm not quite sure. I was on the other side of the fence here during this period, and I was one of the masters being appraised, not doing the appraisals.
So you're not the person to ask this question?
No, I don't think so.
Who would be the person, if a master were rated below average, who would be the person that would make some recommendation about that master?
Right now it would be the ship group coordinator. During this period it would have been the fleet manager or the port captain.
Okay. Thank you, Captain Deppe. You're excused. I have 18:30 hours. Keep smiling. We have one more witness. We'll take a 15-minute break. We'll be back at 6:45 with our last witness for the day.
Keep smiling, the man said. That's Lee Dickinson. He's the head of this Board of Inquiry of the National Transportation Safety Board. We've just finished somewhat of an inquisition, I'd say, of Mr. William Deppe. He's the man who relieved Joe Hazelwood as the master of the Exxon Valdez once it had been aground for, about half a day, something like that. Deppe was quizzed with, let's say, a certain amount of aggression by some of the members of the board about why there's no signatures at the bottom of all these job appraisals. It was almost, Bruce, as if they didn't quite believe him.
That question popped up first, and I sort of passed it by, you know, that there was a sense that they didn't believe him. And then when by the time Dickinson came back at it and Cluccello came back at it and asked the question and pressed again, and they weren't getting the kind of answers they were looking for, and it seems like they're really doubting the validity of this particular document.
These people are pretty tough when it comes to questions of evidence. They don't like to have stuff held back from them, and I guess that's the feeling maybe that is going on here, that they didn't quite get good hard evidence with good custody trail on it to really base it on. I mean, these evaluations are not real good evaluations. They don't know who did them or if Joe Hazelwood ever saw them or what file the original sit in, and they really would like to know those evidential questions.
And beyond that, they're also looking to see if there are other documents on Joseph Hazelwood that they are not getting, and we heard a bunch of questions about that. There is a sense that there must be and that this isn't all there is, that this isn't all she wrote or all he wrote, and that somewhere Exxon has a lot more files on Joseph Hazelwood than it's releasing at this point. So the interesting part is that they did not ask those questions of Frank Iarossi, the man in charge of Exxon shipping and the man who ought to know a lot of these answers. And it'd be interesting to see how the board responds, if it does at all, if it tries to do anything else to try to, in a sense, fill in this information gap that exists right now.
The testimony has been from Captain Depe, and before him was Mr. A man from the Coast Guard who was talking about how through the years there's been kind of an erosion of regulation on tanker traffic, and he was kind of being pinned down as to why these things were, why their crews were allowed to be reduced over and over again, and why pilotage requirements had been reduced. And in fact, there was a plan in the works to make permanent a situation that is sometimes done temporarily, where you don't have to have a pilot aboard through the very waters where the craft went aground. In this case, of course, Joe Hazelwood did have that qualification, but the man who was actually at the helm when Hazelwood went below, Greg Cousins, did not. There are some questions that, and it is, I'd say, a lively possibility in this investigation that Greg Cousins didn't quite know what he was doing at the helm there when he was navigating.
In fact, they put that question to William Depe, who was himself a highly skilled and experienced captain, and he said that he believed that Cousins believed that he knew where he was. But
he believed that he knew where he was, yes.
But he exactly. didn't give any indication that he, in fact, knew where he was. When they spoke to Frank Flynn's, it was a little bit of an echo of the kind of testimony we heard last night. We heard NTSB members taking the Department of Transportation, the U.S. Coast Guard, for task over their drug testing policies. NTSB is clearly not pleased with the fact that after an accident, the Department of Transportation policy does not give them the kind of information that they need, that they test only for four drugs, they don't test for alcohol, and that the Department of Transportation seems to believe it can use urine tests, even though the testimony here has been that urine tests are ineffective unless they're done under very specific conditions, very quickly, right after an accident. And so again, this is kind of a replay of the bureaucratic tussle that we heard last night.
Coming up next will be Denny Kelso. After the break, Dennis Kelso is Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. He's kind of been, up till now at least, the state's lead person on this entire oil spill incident. He's been the one that's been hurling the accusations. He's been the one that went to Washington to testify on this and that and to give the state's view on the oil spill. Increasingly, we're seeing that role being turned over now to Bob Laresch, who is the state's point man in this inquisition, and it'll be interesting to see the relationship between the two of them. It will also be interesting to see what Dennis Kelso is asked and what Dennis Kelso is not asked about the incident from the various people as they try to piece together the account of the wreck of the Exxon Valdez.
That about wraps up our coverage for this hour. We will be back after the break in about 50 minutes. I'm Bruce Melzer. I'm here with Steve Heimel. This is live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board investigation into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. This is brought to you through the facilities of KSKA Anchorage. It's a joint production of KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
On time. I'm Steve Heimel. With me is Bruce Melzer. And this coverage is brought to you by the Alaska Public Radio Network and KSKA Anchorage. The next witness is Dennis Kelso, head of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He's being sworn in even as I speak to you.
I'm the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The state of Alaska, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, sir. Mr. Kacharian will ask you some further questions.
Good evening, Mr. Kelso. How long have you been in your present position?
I've been commissioner since January 5th, 1987.
And what is your previous experience or education?
Prior to becoming commissioner of DEC, I was the deputy commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And prior to that, I was director of a division within the Department of Fish and Game, responsible for managing a research program statewide on the uses of fish and wildlife resources, including fish and wildlife resources in the area that's been affected by the spill.
What is the mission of the Department of Environmental Conservation?
The Department of Environmental Conservation has responsibility under state statute for protecting the quality of the environment, and it does that through pollution control programs, through environmental health programs, and through assistance to communities in areas such as solid waste, water quality, and sewage disposal.
Does the DEC, are they responsible for the state's monitoring review and approval of oil terminal contingency plans?
Yes, under statute, the Department of Environmental Conservation is the only state agency that has that responsibility. We are responsible for all of the state's oil pollution control work, and I have a staff that includes individuals that have basically world-class experience. We have a core team of oil spill response people that includes some staff who frequently get requests from all around the country to come and assist with spills. Two of those folks have a long list of responses, including assignments such as the Argo Merchant, the Li Wang Xin, and other major spills.
Since you've been in charge of the DEC, how has the size of your staff varied in the area of monitoring oil terminals and reviewing contingency plans in that area?
The program began as a terminal and tanker program and was changed over time. That was in 1977. In 1982, the program was changed to include all aspects of oil pollution control. And in 1988, we modified it so that it includes not only oil spill, but also other hazardous substance releases. Our current program staff includes 2.5 positions in the headquarters office and 9 field positions. And those positions are responsible not only for oil spill prevention, but oil spill contingency plan review, oil spill response, and also hazardous substance work as well. In the current budget, what for us is fiscal year 1990, there is an additional $332,000, which represents about 4.5 positions to do this work related to oil spill preparedness and response.
So in your opinion, would those additional people be sufficient to do your job?
The in the area of oil spill, we have, I think, a good, strong core. And with the additional people, we should be able to do the emergency response portion of that work very well. We are also working with the governor's office to supplement the work we do in the area of oil spill contingency plan review. And over the next few weeks, we should know whether some additional funding may be available from an appropriation that the legislature made this session.
Does the DEC have an inspection staff to visit oil terminals such as the Alyeska terminal?
Inspections are done as part of our responsibility within a particular district office or a region office. And in this instance, for example, the Valdez Marine Terminal, that work would be done by the 3 technical staff who are present in Valdez, the Prince William Sound District office. Those people would do inspections in conjunction with their other work, for example, related to Alyeska. But our real way of determining capacity for cleanup is based upon spill drills and actual observations of spill response. In this instance, for example, we had not only spill drills every year since 1984, but also had actual observations. In 1987, there were 85 small spills that we were able to observe response by Alyeska. 1988, there were 65 of those spills. And perhaps most importantly, in 1989, there were 3 spills, 2 in January and 1 in March. And the first of those in January involved 1,700 barrels. It was an excellent opportunity to observe the equipment, the deployment, and the response that Alyeska had committed to under the contingency plan. So that is really the best indicator of how well any particular operator is situated to carry out the requirements of the contingency plan.
You're eliminating a lot of my questions. In the past 5 years, time frame, has Alyeska complied with the regulations as required by DEC?
Alyeska had 3 areas of primary interaction with us. And I would have to say that Alyeska has been resistant to cooperating with us in a number of ways related to pollution control. One part of that, of course, is oil pollution control. We have, in addition to the oil spill work, 2 important areas that involve discharges of oil-related material. One of them is discharges of oil-tainted water from the ballast water treatment plant. And this is a major issue because 18 million gallons of oil-tainted water are discharged by the plant every day. In a related area, more than 300 tons of volatile organic compounds are discharged just from the vessels associated with the Valdez Marine Terminal. And again, that's a hydrocarbon oil product, really, the volatile organic compounds. So we spend a good deal of time in both of those areas. Alyeska has not been cooperative in shouldering their responsibility in that respect. With respect to oil pollution control, it has been a continuous struggle to make sure that the oil spill contingency plan is up to snuff. There has been a long history of challenges to our authority to require a stronger plan, a lot of time delay in order to get Alyeska to take the next steps necessary to do a good job. One example would be their reluctance to include the 200,000 barrel scenario, which we insisted upon, and it was eventually included. We also have, in dealing with Alyeska on this contingency plan, insisted on some very specific strengthening for the plan, not only the 200,000 barrel scenario, but adding exclusionary areas, those areas that are particularly sensitive and where the contingency plan calls for Alyeska to prevent oil from getting into those areas in the first place. We also strengthened the training requirements, and we strengthened the way in which the response was actually carried out based on what we had observed in spill drills. So it has been reluctant. We have stuck to our guns in what we demanded of the company, and what we came out with was a much stronger plan. The statute requires revisions every 3 years. This revision took about 18 months to complete.
Okay, now the volatile compounds you're talking about, those are the vapors from the loading operation?
Vapors from the loading operation, vapors from the vapor recovery system, as well as other discharges associated with the marine terminal. But the figure that I gave you is really just from the vessels, a very large amount of volatile organics.
If Alyeska makes any changes to their operation, for example, in 81, the 20-member emergency team was disbanded. Did they have to clear this with DEC, or how does that work?
The when the team was modified, and there were a couple of changes that were made in that time that you mentioned, we objected to changes and were given assurances by Alyeska that the substitute teams that they were developing would be adequate, and then I believe that that substitute arrangement was reflected in the updated plan when it was revised shortly after that.
I understand that Alyeska Terminal has a response barge. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes. Okay.
It says part of their plan, their contingency plan, did the state require that to be loaded with equipment at all times?
The contingency plan contains a very specific table of equipment and deployment times that are committed to by the company in the plan. We, of course, had recently observed the equipment that they had available because we'd had three of the spills, two in January, one in March, that I mentioned earlier. So it was our expectation that the equipment was fully operational and that they would deploy it as they had committed to.
In those spills, how did Alyeska perform in the cleanup? Did they lose much oil?
The responses were generally adequate. The largest of those we gave a careful scrutiny to because it was a 1,700-barrel spill. It was under conditions that were favorable to a response. So we watched closely to see how that was handled, and it was handled adequately. It was boomed, skimmers operated properly. At one point, there was about 3.5 feet of product within the boom, and although some oil escaped the boom, it was generally an adequate response, and we critiqued it very carefully.
Could you describe the DEC's first 24 hours of involvement in this, in response to the grounding of the Exxon Valdez?
Yes. The head of our Prince William Sound District office in Valdez, Dan Juan, was contacted shortly after 1 o'clock on the morning of the grounding. He immediately initiated the communication chain that we have identified for emergency response. That meant that he mobilized immediately not only his staff, but staff from other offices through his regional supervisor, and he alerted headquarters as well. By a short time after that, within about 2 hours, we had staff either preparing to move or actually moving toward Valdez from all over the state, including the people that I mentioned before who have a great deal of experience around the world in oil spill response. The same individual, Dan Lawn, was on the pilot vessel with the Coast Guard personnel who first went to the Exxon Valdez, and he was on board the vessel. I think the time was approximately 3:30 a.m. As our staff began arriving, they took up their normal duty stations. We kept one staff member, of course, answering the phone and maintaining communications. We put other staff on the way out to the Exxon Valdez. Joe LeBeau is one of the staff who arrived. Interestingly enough, he arrived from the Wasilla office, drove a vehicle basically across two mountain ranges to get to Valdez, and he still arrived on the vessel before the Alyeska equipment arrived. We then continued to bring staff into Valdez. I, of course, was notified in the normal course of carrying out that chain, and at 8:30 in the morning, I convened a meeting of our oil and hazardous substance spill response chief, the director of the division, my deputy, other staff who were involved, and the governor joined us by teleconference from Anchorage, from Fairbanks, excuse me. Then about an hour later, I took off from Juneau on a commercial jet, got to Cordova, went to the Coast Guard rescue station there, flew with the Coast Guard in their H-3 out of Cordova, H-3 helicopter out of Cordova, overflew the spill by early afternoon, and then arrived in Valdez, where I waited very briefly for the governor to arrive from Fairbanks. We then immediately went to a float plane, flew to the vicinity of the tanker, went by smaller Coast Guard vessel over to the tanker, and were on board the vessel by late afternoon, sometime between 4 and 5, close to 5 o'clock. We then spent a couple of hours there. We observed the trial dispersant drop from the helicopter as we were on the deck of the vessel. We had a chance to spend time on the bridge. We talked to Coast Guard personnel on the vessel, and of course, while we were out there, staff from the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Fish and Game, the Division of Emergency Services were all arriving in Valdez. We then returned to Valdez, where I assumed overall command of the operation in Valdez. Our on-scene coordinator was designated, and that was Bill Lamoureux. We maintained Lynn Kent with the regional response team. She stayed in Juneau temporarily to work directly with Captain Haynes on the RRT. And then we basically took over a portion of the court building and put together an emergency response center with biologists, our spill response people, a logistics shop, and basically by that evening, we were fully operational and ready to take what is normally our role, oversight, assessment of damage, and monitoring. As it turned out, we ended up having to take a more direct role in cleanup, but during that first 24 hours, it was our expectation that we were going to be able to stay in our normal role. About 18 hours into the spill, it became clear that Alyeska was not responding under the conditions of the contingency plan, and that neither Alyeska nor Exxon appeared able to carry out the requirements of the plan. And the Alyeska contingency plan is the only document that has been approved for this kind of response. So 18 hours into the spill, we requested that the RRT reevaluate the capabilities of the responsible parties to carry out their duties under the plan and under the law. By early morning on Saturday, we had, and this would be about 24 hours now, I would estimate about 25 people from those different state agencies, and they were on duty. This was not folks arriving and going to the hotel. This was folks arriving and going to the emergency center where we were waiting for daybreak.
What is your, what do you consider your normal role in a spill response?
Our normal role is to oversee the adequacy of the containment and recovery by the responsible party. In this instance, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company has the approved oil spill contingency plan. And it was our expectation, and I think this is what the law requires, that Alyeska make that response. So our expectation had been that we would be working with the Coast Guard, with Alyeska. The Coast Guard clearly is the overall lead as the federal on-scene coordinator. And we respect that. There's no, we had no need to intrude on that responsibility, but we have a specific set of parallel authorities under state law, and that's what we normally would do.
Okay. You said Alyeska wasn't meeting the conditions of the plan, or Exxon, I'm not sure now. What are those expectations that you're talking about?
The plan is very specific about the measures that will be taken at the time a spill occurs. One of the most specific parts of that is delineation of what equipment will be deployed under the 200,000 barrel scenario, which of course is what we were looking at. They also, in the general portion of the contingency plan, commit to mobilizing certain teams and to maintaining control of the spill response as agent for the owner companies, one of whom, of course, is Exxon.
In your opinion, what could have been done during those first 24 hours that wasn't done?
The contingency plan indicates that there will be deployed a number of skimmers, particularly identified amount of boom, and that they would be able to, Alyeska would be able to deploy that and have it operational within 5 hours, even to a point further south than where this tanker grounding occurred. There is also basically a long list of items which Alyeska agreed to do, for example, to mobilize teams, which we saw no evidence of occurring. So when I was on the tanker with the governor, for example, this was well into the first day and far beyond what they had committed to in the plan. We did not see the equipment that they had promised. There was no booming of the leading edge or of the tanker, leading edge of the spill or of the tanker. The only boom deployment that we observed was some lengths of boom that did not appear to be well directed. They may have been part of the two smaller skimmers that were operating. We knew that a larger skimmer should have been deployed, but we did not observe it operating at all during the time we were on board the vessel. It was quite clear to us that what had been promised in the contingency plan was simply not being delivered.
What was the extent of DEC's participation in the RRT meetings?
In the first 24 hours, there was an RRT meeting at 12 o'clock on Friday. We participated with our normal staffing. Lynn Kent is our designee to the RRT, and we sit as a member of the RRT. At that point, the RRT was looking at the overall situation. They discussed the weather. They discussed the movement of the spill, the kind of equipment that was supposed to be moving into the area. It was just a general overview at that point. I think they also discussed the use of dispersants, because dispersants had been pre-approved in Zone 1 by the RRT earlier in March. So that was the kind of discussion, and our participation is as a normal full-scale member of the regional response team.
Is that an advisory position, or how is that?
Well, we sit as a full member of the RRT. We are the state's member to that, and the regional response team advises the Coast Guard on-scene coordinator.
Did Lynn Kent, did she concur with the what was going on at the RRT meeting?
In what respect?
She sat in on all these discussions, and did she make any recommendations or for equipment or do anything that wasn't being done or was in process of being done?
At that initial meeting, of course, the expectation was that there would be the full response that had been promised in the contingency plan. Later in the day, we talked with Lynn Kent because we were not seeing that happen. So Lynn contacted Captain Haynes after we had put together a letter requesting the RRT to reevaluate whether Alyeska and Exxon would really do what had been promised by the contingency plan. And she contacted Captain Haynes directly in order to ask that the RIT take a hard look at just what response was actually being fielded. Then, at that time, we attempted to send by fax a copy of the letter, which could not be successfully transmitted just because of a problem with the receiving end of the fax. So we made sure that the content of that letter was conveyed to Captain Haynes, and then it was communicated by fax first thing in the morning between 8 and 8:30 on Saturday morning.
I'm a little confused. What did that letter say?
The letter indicated that Alyeska had not responded with what was listed in the contingency plan. This really was a this really was a failure of performance under the plan, and we knew that we could not wait for this situation to go further, because our experience with the spill from the Glacier Bay, the tanker Glacier Bay in 1987, in which we worked very closely with the Coast Guard, that experience had shown that we absolutely had to watch exactly what was developing in the way of containment and response, and that we could not wait for the situation to progress beyond the point at which the Coast Guard could take a more directive role. Otherwise, what happened with the Glacier Bay was that for the first 2 days, there was passing of the ball around the circle of potentially liable parties and no cleanup happening. We were determined that that not happen in this instance. We knew clearly who held the responsibility. It was Alyeska. Exxon had come into the picture, of course, but we wanted to make sure that the on-scene coordinator held their feet to the fire, and that if they weren't going to perform, that the decision was made early to intervene rather than to wait until things were out of hand.
Were you aware of some of the activities that Exxon was doing to get equipment to the scene?
To the best of my knowledge, the information that we had from Exxon was only through the RRT and through the press conferences that were held on Saturday.